This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to
oh, God.
This episode of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Now, big weekend of action in college football. I mean, let's just get right to the phone lines. On the line, we have Nick Duke. Nick, how are you?
I'm okay, Paul. How are you?
Doing good. Listen, I can't help but notice certain members of a certain fan base have been very vocal on my show lately.
Well, I wouldn't know anything about that. Although, I'm fairly sure that my wife is related to Daryl from Columbus, so maybe I would know something about that.
I was actually about to pitch to Daryl from Columbus, damn it.
There was a time, like, when I was halfway convinced... I was convincing myself that my father-in-law was Daryl from Columbus, and that one of the aunts on that side of the family was Phyllis from Mulga. But I eventually realized that was not the case because, you know, for various reasons.
Yeah, well, I thought that your father-in-law was an Alabama fan. Actually,
he is. Yes, but that didn't stop me from
contemplating the possibility because the vocal tenors. You know.
It's very similar.
Eerily similar.
Yes.
We should probably introduce ourselves. We are the Hard Traveling Fanboys, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation. And we are coming to you, of course, live via satellite from the Hard Traveling Studios, Ho-Ho Loon Plaza, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, in the L-shaped studio for a very special off-the-page celebrating Walking Dead Month. That's right, Walking Dead Month rolls on by popular demand, or really just because we want it to, and... We're going to be taking.
We're dedicated to gimmicks. We love the gimmicks around here.
Freaking love gimmick months. Mm-hmm. We are taking a look today at a video game that, full disclosure to the listening audience, we haven't played in about 2 years.
I played it actually about 8 to 9 months ago. Was trying to replay it so I would have the save file on my PlayStation 4, so I could play seasons 3 and 4 of Walking Dead, and I got about halfway through this season, my replay of it, and then never finished it.
Well, yes, I last played it about 2 years ago, did finish it, loved it, which we'll talk about here on the show, but we're talking about the second season of Telltale Games' The Walking Dead. The Walking Dead series on Telltale, we talked about last season. We reviewed season 1, mentioned that it really caught us off guard, and ended up becoming perhaps our favorite part of the Walking Dead universe, or certainly up there near the top, and yet another Walking Dead adaptation that we both think is better than the comics.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll get into that a little bit on this show. Get delving into what makes this work, the aspects of it that stand out. And in the rundown, we'll get into a little bit of what's going on right now with the Telltale series. An AMA today actually popped up, timely enough, Nick, about the state of the Telltale game. So
I didn't even see that.
So we'll have to delve into that maybe a little bit. All that being said, Nick, what's new in the world?
Oh, not much. Not much. I survived my trip to Cajun country. Obviously, the outcome of the football game was not what I would have hoped for, but other than that, we had an absolute blast. There have been many reports and internet speculation and rumor and innuendo over the years about the way that LSU fans treat visitors, and I have to say that
especially humans. But the Baton Rouge trip notwithstanding, I'm glad it went well for you, Nicholas. That's a good thing. Mm-hmm. You have really made the rounds to just about every SEC venue now, have you not?
There's a few left off the list. I have not been to Arkansas. I have not been to Texas A&M. I have not been to Florida.
You have not conversed with Rocky Top.
No, I have not been to Florida, Tennessee, and Kentucky. So I got five left. I got nine down, five to go.
Yeah, Mississippi State, right?
I've been to Mississippi State.
Oh, okay. Didn't know that.
I went to Mississippi State my senior year of high school, actually. I got a letter in the mail telling me that I had qualified for some sort of scholarship at Mississippi State, and they were inviting me and my parents to honors weekend at Mississippi State, and I was going to throw it away, and it was like, if you attend, you and your family will be given four tickets to the Georgia-Mississippi State game, and I said, well.
But that was fortuitous, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was interesting. So
I got a similar offer at Southern Miss, but yeah. I got to attend a thrilling Southern Miss UAB game.
Oh, that's even better. Mm. That's even better. This would have been 2005, so that would have been DJ Shockley's 1 year as the starting quarterback at the University of Georgia.
Yes, right after David Green had graduated,
yes,
right?
That is accurate. Yep. That's an accurate statement.
Yes. Have you been to Bryant-Denny?
I have. I went in 2002 with my dad.
Ah, the Coach Fran era.
Was it? Yeah, that was Fran. You're right.
Coach Fran.
Yep. And then, of course, they came back so that was back when you would actually play in back-to-back years, which is not the case anymore.
Mm.
Now those trips are separated by several years, and I'm sure that Tim Capel, in particular, right now is just loving.
It's really loving this conversation. Yeah. It's just like a famous man once said: "You got to keep them separated." Mm-hmm. That man, whoever the guy is that wrote songs for
The Offspring.
Thank you. I totally blew. I was about to call him the Outcast.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that would have been a confluence of worlds, wouldn't it?
I don't know if that word means what you think it means, but perhaps yes.
Whatever. I'm no jurisprudence, but all that aside, we need to talk about the Walking Dead Telltale series. Mm-hmm. Telltale series. Look at me, I'm pulling an old-fashioned Nick Duke. Mm-hmm. Telltale.
Mm-hmm.
Nick, what are the odds that I'll get you to say Telltale about 45 times during the course of this podcast?
Low, very low.
Mm. Well, that notwithstanding, when we left you last year. We had talked about...
You have to go back a full year in the archives to find our last podcast about the Walking Dead Telltale video game series. So go do that. Go stop this podcast. Search for the other one. Find it. Listen to it. And then come back to us.
Yes. Now that you've done that and you've come back to our current podcast, you're just getting all the hard travel and action that you could hope for, because Telltale, off the rousing success of season one, went about the process of sending out season two. And the big difference between season one and season two is the change in lead character.
Mm-hmm.
We move from Lee, who was our main character in season one,
mm-hmm.
and of course, Spoiler alert, for those who haven't played season one of The Walking Dead, this is a major spoiler. So Lee does not make it through the end of season one of The Walking Dead.
And the closing moments actually see you take over playing as Clementine. Mm-hmm. Throughout the game, you don't really realize it until the end, but Lee is coaching Clementine and training her to be able to survive on her own. And then that moment comes, and you have to take on that role as the lead character.
And so season two, Clementine is your lead character. She is your point of view character, the person that you are now in charge of. In a way, Nick, I think one of the reasons that season two worked for me so well is it made me feel like a parent.
Mm-hmm.
Because suddenly I'm given the role that Lee had in season one, the character that we all identified with in season one and led and coached in season one. But now we are given almost this responsibility by Lee to guide Clementine through the rest of her journey. So I don't know about you, Nick, but how did you feel about that going into this season of the game? Did you feel that sort of kinship with Clementine, or, as with me, almost a responsibility to Clementine to keep her safe?
Not necessarily a responsibility. I didn't take it that seriously, but I did definitely feel a kinship with
it. Did you lose sleep? Did you go to church and pray for the safety and the well-being of this character Clementine the way that I did it?
No, but I did. I did pray for the death of a character we'll talk about a little bit later on. This is something that'll be something of a recurring theme. Children that Nick Duke wants to see brutally maimed in the course of the Walking
Dead
universe.
Has there ever been a child in the Walking Dead universe that Nick hasn't wanted dead?
Oh man, that's a tough one. Clementine. I don't want to see Clementine dead.
Good point. Good point.
I had no ill will towards Sophia back then. That's probably about it. That's all I got.
What about Lizzie?
Oh, Lizzie had to go. She certainly had to go. Oh, wait, which one was Lizzie? Was Lizzie the killer?
Lizzie was the crazy.
Okay, yeah, and Mika was the little one, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I had nothing against Mika. There you go. There's another one. So I got three kids that I didn't want dead, by my count, at this point.
What about Henry?
Oh, God. Oh, God.
Anyway.
What was the name of the kid, of the stupid kid with the cookies? Was that Henry?
No, I don't know. Which one was the kid with the cookies?
The kid that got him all brutally murdered because he couldn't shut up. Yeah.
Oh, that kid was the worst. I don't remember what his name was.
I don't know, but he's dead now.
And then there was another kid that you hated because he shot Carl but missed.
Oh, that kid! No, he didn't miss! He literally shot him in the face at point blank range, and somehow Carl gets out with only missing an eye. The bullet it was a magic bullet that steered around his brain and went out the back of his head. Unbelievable.
By which you mean literally unbelievable.
I mean, it just makes no sense. Thanks a lot, Robert Kirkman. Which we haven't gotten to that point in the comic book yet, but I know Carl loses an eye. I'm assuming that's how it happens. But we'll get there eventually. About 6 years from now, Greg, when Walking Dead month is still roaring on, we will be to that point in the comic. We will be on like volumes 10 and 11 out of 48 or whatever, however stupid many numbers of volumes there are. Folks, if you can't tell right now, we don't remember a lot of the finer details about this video game, but we decided to do this show anyway. So what we're doing is we're stalling for time
by talking about
a bunch of other bullshit that you probably don't care about.
Stuff.
Yeah. We talked about football. We talked about Paul Feinbaum. Now we're talking about murdering children. This is great.
It wouldn't be a show for us, Nick, if we didn't talk about all those things for just a moment.
Yes.
The point being all that is there is a kinship with Clementine. We grew to love Clementine over the course of season one, and that bond only strengthens in season two as she is the lead character. She is a character that you're kind of responsible for, and you want to protect her. You want to make sure that she makes the right choices and survives. And, most importantly, you want her to avoid making the mistakes, at least I did, that I made with Lee in season one, of trusting people.
Put some because stank there's on one that. Mistakes! I like that. That was good.
The one thing in the Walking Dead universe that has been consistent until Rick Grimes' idiotic decision at the end of last season, people in the Walking Dead universe can't do it.
DTA, as Stone Cold Steve
might
say.
Their ass with a stunner. Yep. When they least expect it.
Yep.
Especially if they're rotten. But we'll get to that. You're now in the shoes, if you will, or the baseball cap of Clementine.
Mm-hmm.
And it picks up not long after the kind of ambiguous ending of season one. Remember, Clementine sees someone off in the distance.
Mm-hmm.
Tree, and at the time you're not sure if this is a friend or a foe, But it ends up that Clementine saw Omid and Krista, two characters that we encounter in season one.
Fairly late in the season. And, they were fairly late additions to the cast. I think they came in either episode 3 or episode 4. So you didn't have as much time to bond with them as you did characters like Lee and somebody else we'll talk about here in a little bit as well.
Right. And we should mention, episode 3 or 4, these are 5-episode seasons. The Telltale Games are all divided into 5 episodes. So
except for the last season, apparently. Even when it finishes, it was only ever going to be 4 episodes. So that's interesting that this one will break from the 5-episode format.
It is. It is curious, because all the Telltale Games that I have played have been in that
format. The tables have turned, Darkness.
Osmosis. Mm-hmm. I've absorbed
Osmosis Jones.
What's that? No, I've never seen Osmosis Jones. Actually,
that was the name of it, though, right?
Yeah. It had that guy in it.
Orlando Jones.
He was that actor. Orlando Jones. Yes, he was prolific back in his heyday.
He was in the what was that movie with Eddie Griffin? Remember that movie?
Double Take. Well, he was also in He was also in Juana Man,
Man, yes.
Do you remember that, Juana Man?
I do.
Because it's supposed to sound like, do you want a man?
Yes. And he was a man dressed up as a woman.
Right.
That was the joke, you see.
Double meaning to it, He was also in The Replacements, which is how I best know him. He played, of course, the legendary character Clifford Franklin in The Replacements.
He also played the magazine salesman in Office Space in that one scene.
Yes. He was in Evolution, if you remember that movie.
Oh, I do remember Evolution. Yeah, David Duchovny and Julianne Moore and Orlando Jones playing.
He played Professor Harry Block, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my question for you is, Nick, I've always heard that Evolution is a mystery.
Now, I've heard that it's full of change that no one sees.
That's interesting. Do you find that? I don't know if this is the right lyric. Never mind.
The clock makes a fool of history. Yeah, I do find that. For somebody who proclaims for that to be like your favorite wrestling theme of all time, you would think you might, I don't know the first 3 lines of the song.
Listen, I thought the lyric was "God makes a fool of history," so that shows you how much I know.
Maybe it is. I don't know. It is.
I can't understand what Lemmy's saying half the time. I just know the song is awesome.
Lemmy can't understand what Lemmy is saying half the
time. It's about a feeling, man.
And again, we're off the rails on this one.
Absolutely. Point being, somehow Osmosis Jones. But nonetheless, Osmosis Jones is not in The Walking Dead Season 2. But Krista and Omid are. And so there's a flash forward here, and I'm trying – it says several months, so I'm reading a recap here. But there is a flash forward from the end of season – or a passage of time from the end of season 2
to
beginning of season 3.
The opening scene of season 1 – or season 2 takes place shortly after the events of season 1 because Krista is still pregnant, as we found out she was – in season 1, and then Omid meets a tragic end that Clementine is partially responsible for, and then Krista, obviously this hardens the relationship between Krista and Clementine, and then we flash forward like a year and a half, Krista's no longer pregnant, we don't know what's happened to the baby, nobody has really said anything about that, but we know that
I have not conversed with the baby.
But we know something has gone poorly, as it relates to her pregnancy, and... But she and Clementine are still together, and then that kind of kicks off the events as they eventually get separated, and off we go.
Yes, they get attacked, and that attack kind of sets the stage for everything that is to come. We never, to my memory, Nick, I don't think we ever see Krista again in this season, do we?
And not in this season. I don't know if she pops up in season 3 or season 4, but not in season 2. We have not seen her again.
So that's the last you see of her, for now, anyway. And then Clementine meets an entire new group of people. And I think this is kind of cool, because what it does is it adds Clementine's self-sufficiency, because Kristen Omid still had that role of like caretakers for Clementine, and this is the first time in her life that she's not really had a caretaker. She has to fend for herself and use a lot of the lessons that Lee taught her to get by. And in the meantime, she does get by and encounters a new group of people that include pretty much our new cast of characters for this season. So these characters include Carlos, a kindly doctor, his daughter, Sarah, who suffers from some sort of condition, an anxiety disorder or something like that. As you can tell, Nick does not like her because she is disabled.
I see what you're trying to do here.
Just kidding.
You're trying to paint me into a corner.
Well, tell me what you don't like about Sarah.
She relies on you for everything, and she is incapable of doing anything herself, to the point where all she succeeds in doing throughout the course of the entire season is getting Clementine in trouble and making things more difficult for you. She is like, she is the Walking Dead Telltale version of those annoying, like, oh, what do you call them? You know when you're in a video game, Greg, and you have to, like, just walk alongside someone and make sure they don't die and they don't contribute anything useful to the mission.
Yes.
That is what she is.
Your only role is to protect them.
Yes, yeah. that is what she is in this universe, and it is unbearable.
So she becomes something of a sort of friend to Clementine, like, because she's the closest to Clementine's age.
She becomes an anchor tied to Clementine's ass is what she becomes.
The interesting thing about Clementine and Sarah's relationship is Clementine is appears to be probably, what, 3 years younger than her?
Probably.
Somewhere around there. And yet Clementine is by far the more mature of the two. Mm-hmm. Like, Clementine is closer to being an adult than Sarah, who at times acts like, you know, a 6 or 7 year old child. And part of that is because she has been, but part of that is because she does have some sort of, clearly has some sort of condition. The second part is that she has been
sheltered
severely by her father, Carlos. And this creates an interesting dynamic between Clementine, who technically is a kid, but can't be a kid around Sarah because Sarah is so immature and so so maladjusted to this new post-apocalyptic world. Anyway, you also meet Alvin and Rebecca.
Yes.
Alvin is a really nice character. He's actually at first the nicest guy in the group to Clementine. He seems to be a good man. His wife, Rebecca, not so good.
No.
She is visibly pregnant, and I guess you can attribute it partially to the fact that she's pregnant and her hormones are going crazy, but Rebecca is a stone-cold bitch to Clementine. Would you agree, Nick?
I would 100% agree. She's awful. I mean, she just, all she does is question Clementine's motives at all times. She's the pregnant female black Randy Savage, essentially.
I never would have thought to make that comparison, Nick, but I suppose there are things. There's some things, I'm not saying it's true, but there's some things to
it. There's some things about it.
Now, you know, normally we wouldn't hate a character for questioning other people's motives. I mean, Dr. Kevin Nash questioned motives all the time.
That's a good point, but in this case, these are our motives because we're playing as Clementine, and who is she to question our motives just because she's pregnant, thinks everybody has to walk around and you know, do whatever she says just because she's pregnant.
Now, Nick, you've had a pregnant wife before on account of you have kids now. What's that like?
It's wonderful.
Isn't it good?
It's the best thing.
I thought so. I thought that's what you said at the time. I remember that. I remember that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
You said those words exactly.
I said, this is the best thing I've ever experienced. That's what I said.
Yep.
I said that.
I wish life was like this year-round, you said.
That. I said that. Yep, I wish it could be like this permanently.
But sadly, that's not the way it works.
No, it's not. No, it is not. Not unless I were Amish or Catholic, probably. Then it could
be that way. Hey, yo. Wait a minute. Where are we at now? Oh, yeah. So
Mormons are the ones. Who has all the damn kids? Mormons? I don't know.
A bunch of
you know the ones.
I don't know.
Too many of them. Too many damn kids.
The rent is too damn high.
There are too damn many children. That's my that's my feeling on the Walking Dead universe. There are too damn many children.
There really aren't that many, though.
There are too damn many, though.
Oh, my. You need to ask yourself, Nick. I know what you need to ask yourself. If you're so mad at the kids,
I need to ask myself while we're 25 minutes into this podcast and still only talking about like the first three scenes of episode one.
You need to look around at the adults in The Walking Dead, and you need to say to yourself, "Who's gonna fill their shoes? Who's gonna stand up tall?"
All right, what's the next line there? Big boy.
Who's going to play the Opry or the Wabash?
I knew you couldn't get through saying Wabash Cannonball without laughing. You laugh every time.
What the hell is a Wabash Cannonball, Dick? Answer me that. Can you answer me that?
Well, I can tell you it was a song back in the day performed by a variety of individuals. But it was a song about a train that was called the Wabash Cannonball because it traveled on the Wabash Railroad.
At the same speed at which a cannonball would travel?
It's kind of like, that Willie Nelson song, you know, the one, riding on the city of New Orleans in the song, the city of
New Orleans. The one they call the city of New Orleans.
Right, but the city of New Orleans is a train. It's the Wabash Cannonball's a train.
Trains have some stupid-ass names in country music.
Apparently, it was written in 1904 and popularized by Roy Acuff.
Ah, yes, Roy Acuff. I remember him.
Do you actually?
I don't know. Is it possible that I remember him? Was he even alive when I was a child?
No, but that doesn't stop us.
No, I know a lot of people. I've heard of Roy Orbison. Glasses and whatnot. Anyway, so we also meet. Who else do we also meet here? Luke. Use the force, Luke. We meet Luke, and he ends up being a nice man. He's a young.
He's a nice man.
He's a good young man.
I like him.
And he's good. He is a handsome young man, Luke, and he takes a liking to Clementine, not in that way. The rest of the group doesn't trust Clementine, you see, but Luke and Alvin trust Clementine more than the others. There's also Luke's best friend, Nick.
Mm-hmm.
Nick, did you like Nick?
I don't think so. I don't remember.
No, Nick was a bit of a drunk, remember?
He was great.
Yeah, wait a minute. Hmm. And then, of course, there was Nick's uncle, Pete. And Pete was cool. Pete takes Clementine fishing and really takes Clementine under his wing a little bit because, he's kind of an older gent. And so he's, older people like having kids around, makes them feel younger. So Pete is nice to Clementine as well. They go fishing and whatnot. But unfortunately, Nick is kind of a screw-up.
Mm-hmm.
So Nick is always trying to encourage the group to leave Clementine behind because she's been bit by a dog, and they're not sure if it was a walker bite or if they can trust her or not. And, Nick's always trying to take a shortcut. So at some point, Pete ends up getting bit. And once that happens, unfortunately, you do lose... this is a major spoiler, but you lose Pete, and I don't want to spoil a bunch of crap about this game for people that might want to play it, because it is a great game, but the personality conflicts here are such that Nick is kind of the person, for me anyway, of this initial group that you meet, that I'm like, I was adamantly already anti-Nick when this started, as in the character Nick, not Nick Duke, but... Nick and I'm looking here at the characters that I didn't like. I didn't like Rebecca. Oh, gosh.
No,
Rebecca and Nick were the two worst. I didn't mind Carlos.
Sarah was awful.
I can understand that.
You defended Duck last year the entire time, but sorry. You will not defend Sarah this time. I know.
I was sympathetic towards Sarah.
You were sympathetic while also wishing she would go tie her dead weight to somebody else.
I was hoping that her and Carlos would leave the group. And then, of course, there was Pete, who I liked, and then Luke. What did you think about Luke, Nick?
Luke was good. He's just generic nice guy. There's not really much that stands out about his personality.
That's a good way of putting it.
He's the Clark Kent of the group, essentially.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. And anyway, they end up running afoul of – now, they make the biggest mistake that you can make in the Walking Dead universe, which I intentionally foreshadowed this earlier, Nick. The biggest mistake you can make in the Walking Dead universe is you trust somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And these dumbasses – that's right, I said it. These dumbasses end up trusting Bonnie.
Mm.
But I'll get to that in a minute. Because first – they end up having to leave their cabin after Clementine encounters the lead villain of this piece, which I actually want to delay talking about because I feel like we'll probably have the most to say about this guy, Nick.
Mm-hmm.
They end up crossing this – you end up going across this river. You encounter more characters. There's a lot of great drama here that I don't want to spoil. But do we want to reveal the character from season one that you revisit?
Sure.
So you eventually find out that Kenny somehow survived
mm-hmm.
his incident from the end of season one, but he and in the meantime he's met a woman and settled down. Her name is Sarita, and but it's clear that Kenny has been greatly changed and affected by everything that happened in season one, losing his family, almost being devoured by walkers. You know, depending on your choices, leading to the death of Ben, another shit child character in The Walking Dead. So it's clear that Kenny has something's off about him. Even Sarita mentions that Kenny has moments where he zones out or just, you know, loses his mind. But nonetheless, it's a very heartwarming moment for Clementine to be reunited with Kenny because this is the first person that she's come across, that she's recognized in since her separation from Krista and Omid. And Kenny is somebody who was very much a part of her life, almost from the very beginning of her encounters with Lee.
Mm-hmm.
I think you meet Kenny in, is it not the first episode of season one?
Yeah, you meet him at the farm when you make it to Herschel's farm in season one, episode one.
That's right. And indeed you do talk to your boy.
Mm-hmm.
So they're all reunited, and it feels so good. There's a new character named Walter. Walter, Nick. Mm-mm. Sensing a pattern here, Nick?
I'm not. I sense no pattern.
Wonder if his middle name was Don.
Those are two separate characters.
Anyway, Walter has a very – again, I don't want to spoil any of this because I love the morality twist in all these games, and this is one of the really great ones involving Walter and what you have to do as Clementine. But eventually, a character named Bonnie comes around who we encountered in the 400 Days DLC that came out after the first season of The Walking Dead. And in that, Bonnie was one of our protagonists, right? We took control of Bonnie and probably had one of the better of those stories in 400 Days. But now she's come to the group and she's begging for supplies. She says that she needs supplies, she needs help from the group, and there's a lot of skepticism regarding Bonnie. Pretty much everybody seems to be skeptical, but Walter gives her supplies, sends her back. This ends up putting them in the crossfire of what it really was a scouting venture that Bonnie was doing for her attacking group, led by the evil man known as William Carver.
Mm.
And he is voiced, of course, by Michael Madsen, who people know from...
Oh, yeah, he was. I didn't even know. Now that you say it, I hear it, but you know it was something I didn't pick up on the first time.
People may recognize him from Quentin Tarantino movies. He's been in all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
Famed actor. And Carver really transforms this season of The Walking Dead. Because up to this point, it's been good,
mm-hmm.
but this is the point when it becomes great.
Yes.
This season. Carver...
And it's interesting in that like there hasn't really been... you know, other episodes have had, you know, one-off villains. Like, I'm thinking of specifically
the cannibals
on the farm or whatever. But this guy kind of stretches across the bulk of the season. Like, he's there, you know, the first three episodes, kind of either looming in the background or as the direct threat. And so it's interesting to see this game attempt something of a longer form villain approach, which works in this case.
It really does. The closest comparison to Carver I could come up with would be, he's almost like a hybrid, is he not, of the Governor and Negan.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, like the Governor, he fancies himself the peacekeeper, this keeper of law and order, and creates the illusion of somebody who is concerned with law and order. But behind the scenes, he is this aggressive, selfish, domineering bully of a man, much like Negan. And it's this combination of the Governor's political-minded quest for power alongside Negan's just bullying, aggressive demeanor.
Yeah, I would agree. You see him throughout the course of the episode just engage in pretty terrible acts. He rules this home improvement store you wind up going to with an iron fist. Everybody kind of lives there under his law, essentially, following his orders. And it's revealed that the reason he is chasing this group so heavily is that he and Rebecca got it on, and he is convinced that her child is not Alvin's child, but is instead his child.
He actually gets former WCW and WWE wrestler Scott Steiner at one point to look at Rebecca and say, "Your baby has my eyes!"
Yeah. Yes, he does. And then Scott just walks off into the sunset, never to be seen again.
And, so Carver really, like you said, Nick, changes the dynamic of the game. He's a long-form villain, and I thought he was just dynamic. it really transforms this entire season in a major way, and gives it that different element that season one didn't have, where instead of being a clone of our experience in season one, now it's really for the first time, a long-form quest of survival, where it's like, you don't know what kind of depraved thing that Carver's going to do next. You don't know who he's going to kill, who he's going to torture, who he's going to maim. And you really, over the course of three, as a gamer, grow to hate this guy. As great a villain as he is, I think that's what makes him a great villain, is that, like, by the second episode, I was ready to kill this guy. Like, he is such an unrepentantly evil character that you really want him to die, and they need to deliver a satisfying conclusion to this, and I'm not going to spoil it, but they deliver a very satisfying conclusion to this, Nick.
Yes, I would wholeheartedly agree, and I would argue that it's a conclusion that perhaps the television show should have taken some inspiration from last season.
Yes, a conclusion that would make Mr. Tarkanian proud.
Yes.
Speaking of Mr. Tarkanian, Nick, I had to deal today on the phone with the editorial director of
the former editorial director of digital media at Marvel.com, Ben Morse?
No, another editorial director of one of the top five in-flight magazines in the country.
In the world.
But nonetheless, so the Carver saga, I just cannot stress enough how great it is. And then right when you think there's no way they can follow the Carver saga, it becomes this frantic, almost hopeless fight for survival amongst your group that you're a part of with Clementine. And you also encounter a few more characters along the way, a character named Jane, who is kind of this lone wolf character that just happens to come across your group and join it for a little while. There's a character, what's his name? The other guy. Let me see if I can find his name. I'm drawing a blank here. Mike. You encounter Mike at Carver's place, and he joins your group. So you pick up a few other people, but there's an increasing feeling of desperation as this game develops, that you're out of supplies, you're out of food, you've got a baby on the way, by the way. Rebecca's about to give birth to a baby, so you have to keep that in mind. You've got scavengers that are after the same stuff that you're after. It is really – does one of the better jobs of a game that I've played of making me feel like – making me feel how desperate the characters are, if that makes sense.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. Nothing comes easily. You know, obviously you know that over the course of the season you're probably going to topple whatever obstacles are put in front of you. But like you said, everything is a struggle, and everything is something you have to claw for. So, good point. Good observation on your part.
Everything is evil.
Mm-hmm.
So all of this kind of almost culminates. We're not quite to the culmination yet, but we get to the sort of semi-final act here, where you encounter that revolves around a Russian teenager named Arvo. That's right, Arvo. And Arvo appears to be a member of an opposing group, but one that seems to be kind of sniveling, kind of meek, and so kid Clementine and a few other characters take pity on Arvo and allow him to accompany them and help, quote, lead them to safety. Well, along the way, Arvo does some things and says some things that are just, well, Nick, there's no other way to put it, but they're assholish in nature.
Now, and like what?
I don't want to say. I don't want to ruin the gaming experience.
Oh,
for people that
have God's sake. Let me tell you, your problem is you, sir, have an anti-Russia agenda that is shining through in what you're saying here.
Well, Nick, do you have a pro-Russia agenda?
No, I don't have a pro-Russia agenda. I'm just saying.
What are your thoughts Vladimir Putin?
Let's keep an open mind. If we can have a good relationship with him, why wouldn't we want to have a good relationship with him so we can make deals, the best deals?
Now, what if he's not living up to his end of said deals?
We'll just make him.
Oh, okay. Well, that sounds good. I don't see a problem with that. Arvo is a piece of garbage, though. There have been great Russians before. I was a big fan of Ivan Drago, a legendary Russian boxer. I was a big fan of I wasn't. That would be a blatant lie if I said that I was a fan of Nikolai Volkov or Boris Zhukov. Zumov, rather. But, no, Zhukov, yeah. Nikita Koloff, the Russian nightmare. I mean, come on. Ivan Koloff, the Russian bear.
Mm-hmm.
But Arvo is not nearly the man those two are. He's not a man at all. He's a cowardly person who deserves to be eaten by walkers.
My goodness. Strong words here on poor Arvo.
Captain Insano.
Your issue with Arvo is that late in the game, a certain character develops a dislike for him, and it's your true. Blind loyalty to certain characters in this game is puzzling, and quite frankly...
Nope.
Ill-sighted.
Nope. Because certain characters just call it like it is.
Certain characters are clearly going through mental collapse over the course of the season.
I would argue that almost every character on this game is going through a slow...
You were the one just going on a minute ago about how, oh, I felt this responsibility to really take care of Clementine. Yeah, send her off with old mental patient over there.
Oh, no. Clementine, if it came down to it, Clementine could take care of Kenny if she had to. But here's the thing.
Certain individuals, sorry.
So, but here's the thing with certain individuals. Certain individuals are the only individuals in the game who had proven a long-term commitment and loyalty to Clementine.
Because he's the only character that returns from Season 1.
No, but not just that. The other characters don't make their decisions with Clementine in mind. They're all about themselves. Nice. Rebecca cares about her and hers. Luke ultimately cares about him and his.
It doesn't matter. He's losing it. Greg, he's literally going insane.
Doesn't matter.
That does matter.
He's fine.
He's not fine.
When he's losing his, you know what he is? He's that great quarterback that's the right thing to do for the team.
Well, there you
and
go.
In this case,
either check it down or just hold it.
Just hold it.
Just
forever.
Stand there with it.
If you hold it, eventually something good will happen.
Yeah, eventually. For somebody.
Anyway, Kenny at least is going to do is a moral person. Do you know who's not a moral person?
Who?
Certain other people that
certain other
you
people.
That you yeah. would have selected to go with in that
I did.
Situation.
Certain not would have
who directly endanger the life
made...
of a small baby to try to send a point about someone another individual.
What does that matter?
That's the
You know, no, your argument was just, oh, he's the only one that cares about Clementine. So are we worried about caring about Clementine, or are we worried about caring about everybody else? What is your argument here, Greg?
I don't think these two things are mutually exclusive.
So you think an insane person should be put in charge of an infant?
He is not insane. He has moments of anger or moments of lapses in judgment, but for the most part,
he is losing his mind.
He's not losing it any more fastly than he was earlier. Quickly, certain people anyway.
His new wife gets killed, and he starts talking about Duck, who's been dead for what is implied to be almost 2 years at this point. He starts talking about all this crazy stuff. He starts seeing, you know, his dead wife in a white dress. He starts picking up ringing phones and having stupid, boring conversations. Stuff that nobody cares about.
He starts eating pudding.
Oh, God. No.
No. No.
Let me tell you what it is you like about Kenny. He's a redneck from South Florida. That's what you like about him.
What's your deal with that? Why would I like that?
Well, I don't know why.
Let me tell you why. Your character that you like so much, Miss. Oh, I'm going to do the right. I'm a cool badass loner character.
Yes.
Gonna come out of nowhere. Yes. You know what she does? She puts the baby's life. I almost said his name, but that's not a spoiler. AJ's life. She puts AJ's life as a baby in danger, locking him in a car with walkers around him. To pretend that he's been taken, to send a message to Clementine about Kenny losing his mind, but even though Kenny only loses his mind here because he assumes, as anyone would, that this other person murdered a baby!
Who loses his mind, Greg?
A certain person.
Fucking Kenny!
Who loses his mind because he thinks rightly that this other person murdered a baby. And I would argue that Kenny's reaction is tame for what you should do to someone who murders a baby.
I would, you know, and I would disagree. He's been slowly, steadily going insane for the course of the game, essentially, the season. And you got to get away from him. He's just, you don't need that crazy in your life.
Well, sir, while I disagree with your opinion, I defend to the death your right to have it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what we've just done here is...
And by the way, may I remind you that if you make the choice to do what needs to be done, he will tell you himself you did the right thing.
He's a good person. That's what a good person would say in that situation. Now, if you go my route and you really do the right thing...
No.
And you side with the person that's been there the whole time for you, then you get to have an even more emotional ending. Because the ending of this season, I'll be honest with you, wrecked, because of the path that I chose, wrecked me even more than the ending of season one did. It was, from an acting standpoint, from a video game directing standpoint, it was a masterpiece of a scene, and they were crying. I'll admit I was becoming emotional watching it, it moved me emotionally, Nick, in the way that yesterday's lunch from Taco Bell moved my innards in a way that was unnatural.
Hmm. Well, I mean, there are several different endings, though, so I don't know which one you got.
Well, I don't want to, you know, I made Slayton choices. I went
but even that direction, there
offers a branching, there's
several different endings.
I made the branching decision that results in certain characters not staying with certain characters beyond said ending.
Mm.
And it was a heart-wrenching decision to make, and a truly... And that's what I love about this season, even above season one, is there are more choices here. This is a more divergent ending than any way you can go about season one. And the choices you make in this game make a real difference in how it ends. And I was not prepared for the level of difference when I went back and replayed it and went to go with the other person. I was not prepared for the level of difference between the two endings because they're very different.
Apparently there's even a third ending.
Yes, I don't even know that I ever went back and looked at that one.
Mm-mm.
But I know I've read that it exists where both of the other people aren't involved. And
as a matter of fact, even according to the statistics on the Walking Dead wiki, that is actually the most commonly chosen ending by players.
Oh, wow.
At 25.7%.
I just figure that there's strength in numbers. Mm-hmm. So I would want Clementine to be with someone else, but it's such a great game, though. I mean, that's ultimately what it comes down to, is the game makes you care about these characters, in particular Clementine, care about the decisions that you make, because a lot of times these Telltale games have been criticized in the past for the illusion of choice, and I get that. But I think Season 2 of The Walking Dead is one of the best jobs they've ever done at actual ramifications of your decisions.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not going to wow you from a gameplay standpoint, I don't think. I don't think it's going to bring anything in terms of action mechanics or camera movement that's just going to wow you. But it's a game that's based around story and plot and choice and feeling like your choices have a tangible effect on the story. So if that's what you're into, if you want to look for something like that, there's probably no better example of a narrative branching story than these Telltale Walking Dead games.
And a strong argument can be made that from a narrative standpoint and from a character standpoint, that this video game series, at least through two seasons, does a significantly better job than the comic book or the TV show in terms of consistency and characterization.
Well, I mean, when the TV show was at the peak of its powers, I think it was just as good as the
that's fair.
The video game, you know, season what did we discuss on the countdown?
Three and four.
We think it's like seasons two through four. Seasons three and four. You're right. Would be right up here at this level, but I would say the video game series, these two seasons, are easily better than, like, the last three seasons of the television show. So, there you are. And it's better than anything ever associated with the comic book ever that I've read.
That we've read, yeah. Well, very, very good discussion here, Nick, and by very good, I mean all over the place, and only tangentially related to the actual topic we decided to discuss, but...
Right.
Cliff's Notes version, this game's really good. You can probably find it for very cheap, either through the PlayStation Store, or if you go up to your local GameStop, you can probably find it used really cheap as well. I would highly
recommend it. There was a physical edition, I think, that eventually came out. And also, I don't know, I don't think plans for this were canceled, but there were plans to release it on Nintendo Switch, an updated version. We will see if that still happens or not.
Go get a copy of it. You won't regret it, I don't think, anyway. Like I said, it's not a game that you're going to love for the gameplay, although it is a little bit cleaned up from season one. They fix a little bit of the quick time events. It plays a little bit more smoothly. But this isn't a game that you're getting if you want action. This is a game you're getting because of the characters and the story. And you will be surprised at some of the decisions you make in the heat of the moment, because you are timed on some of these decisions. So good stuff all around. We want to talk to you about it. So if you have played the game, let us know what you thought about it. If you haven't, if you want to ask us questions about it, if you want to play it now and let us know what you think as you play through it, let us know. Contact us on Twitter. I am at gphillips8652. He is at nickduke87. You can find us on the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. Just type in Place to Be Nation Comics. You'll find us. Join the discussion there. Twitter at PTBN Comics. You can find us there as well. The loneliest email address is on the internet. GregP@PlaceToBeNation.com. NickD@PlaceToBeNation.com. Send us your feedback. Let us know what's up. And other than that, Nick, any final thoughts on this? Or should we go ahead and head to that that wonderful, beautiful bean footage known as the commercial break?
The bean footage. Let's go to the bean footage right now.
Roll that beautiful bean footage.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, Main Event, Survey Says, Wrestling Warzone, a Monday Night Wars podcast retrospective, No Holds Barred, Jeff Learns Wrestling, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. On top of that, we're also dipping into the vault, re-releasing the entire catalog of Where the Big Boys Play for your enjoyment. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is loaded with great content, offering such tremendous shows covering the land of pop culture, such as Geek and Sassy, Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Sunday Groove, PTBN Play, Freak Out Drive-In, Songs with Friends, Looking Forward, Looking Back, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Conversation Comics, DC Post Crisis Management, Marvel Age, and Marvel Age Masterclass, plus weekly pod blasts that cover the gamut of comic topics. The feed is also filled with insightful sports content, including the NBA team, This Week in the NFL, and more.
And you can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com. We cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon while doing your online shopping. And download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back from the break, ladies and gentlemen. We hope you enjoyed your few moments of peace and quiet away from our shrill, loud, argumentative voices. We are back, though, to offer the rest of the story. Right, Nick?
Absolutely, much like Paul Harvey. But unlike Paul Harvey, there will be no life lesson, no moral lesson here. We have nothing to offer as it relates to morality.
Now, you just don't understand, Paul. You don't understand what it is that you do for us. When y'all come out here and you argue about comics like this, you're performing a service for the audience, Paul. I mean, Paul, this is like, for us, Paul, this is therapy. This takes us away, Paul, from the world around us, Paul.
Well, listen, thank you for saying so. Next caller.
Feinbaum callers, kind of like the southern prayers, where it's like, if you say God enough times in the prayer, he'll hear you extra loud.
Lord, we just want to thank you, Lord, and we just want to praise you, Lord.
I just want to, like, the editor, the writer in me just wants to, like, edit the sentence. Like, you know, he got it the first time, you know. It takes me out of the situation is what I'm saying. When I'm saying grace, and, you know, it's like a, you know. Anyway, this is getting into the weeds a little bit. But let's get into the portion of the show where Nick yawns, also known as every single episode.
Also known as anytime Greg speaks.
Exactly. But what I am going to speak about right now is our weekly look at the news and notes in the world of comics. Nicholas, what's our name for this little segment?
It's, reckon it's the Rundown.
It is you're getting pretty close there. It is the Rundown, and we are here to talk about all
that scene in Sling Blade where Carl Childers is just being told shit he doesn't want to hear, and he just sits there and stares ahead. Damn right.
That Mr. Bill Cox say. So we have to start off the Rundown, Nick, by acknowledging that we had an inaccurate prediction recently.
We did. We were dogging Venom in the weeks up leading up to its release, in the months leading up to its release.
Even up until the critical reviews of it came out.
Yeah, and the critical reviews were not strong. They were not strong. But that being said, it has found an audience. Won the box office 2 weeks in a row, set an October box office record for a debut weekend. You know, Venom to this point has been something of a, you know, it's not doing summer dollars. It's not doing Marvel movie, you know, MCU dollars, but it's doing big business, and it's enough to I think, make Sony feel comfortable moving forward with their Spider-Man associated universe that does not have Spider-Man in it.
Right. Apparently, the success of Venom has only spurned on their cravenous plan to expand this universe of Spider characters.
Their what plan? Craven.
But apparently, the latest report is that the planned Craven the Hunter movie is a go, as screenwriter Richard Wink is working on it and is planning to include Spider-Man, unlike Venom. He says it's in the Spider-Man universe. It's going to adhere very closely to the comic book lore. He'll come face-to-face with Spider-Man. And it will be based on the legendary J.M. DeMatteis story, Kraven's Last Hunt. A story that I've actually never read, but have heard is many people's favorite Spider-Man story of all time. Nick, what do you make of this story?
I think it's short-sighted and silly on a variety of levels. One, you can sit there and say, yeah, we're going to have Spider-Man in it, but you would have to work out some sort of agreement with Tom Holland to appear, unless you're going to cast your own version of Spider-Man, which if you do that, good luck to you, because you've already proven you'll screw that up eventually.
And Warner Brothers has taught us that there's no way that audiences can accept multiple versions of the same character on film. So.
Right, that's exactly right. And also, again, having not read Kraven's Last Hunt, which I understand, I get that. It's one of my biggest Spider-Man blind spots. I need to get around to it. I'm not debating that. But based on what I know about the story, it relies on something of a knowledge of the character of Kraven. You know, Kraven's last hunt can't also be Kraven's first hunt. You know what I mean? And so if you're coming out of the gates doing Kraven's Last Hunt as the first movie ever to feature Kraven in it, don't you think it will lose something in the translation?
Right. Plus, we need to tackle... Now, granted, we have been very negative about... Both of us have been very negative about the Spider-Man-less Spider-Man universe that Sony wants to build. And the success of Venom would seem to prove us wrong. However, there's a cavern mm-hmm. of difference yes. between...
Venom actually has Venom a following. And Kraven. Venom has a fan base. Venom has a bit of name recognition and brand value that characters like Kraven, Silver Sable, Black Cat, Morbius the Living Vampire, what, not saying they're not good characters, but people don't know those
popular,
characters.
But they're not household yeah. names.
Right. People don't know those characters. People aren't going to come out to see those movies based on the name alone, the way there was at least a portion of the audience that was willing to do that with Venom.
Venom was one of the most popular comic book characters at a time when comic books as a medium mm-hmm. were much more popular than they are today mm-hmm. as a single issue monthly storytelling medium. Kraven, not so much. I mean, you didn't see Kraven Lethal Protector in the early 90s. You didn't see a video
He's
game.
A lethal protector, but he doesn't have to be violent.
He doesn't have to be violent. They're two different things, two different businesses. Mm-hmm. You didn't see Kraven in video games in the early 90s as like his own playable character carrying the game. Venom is a character that carries a certain cultural cache with him that these other side characters don't necessarily. Now, granted, if this movie does prove to be especially popular long-term with audiences, perhaps there is a way to capitalize on that. And use, hey, if you liked Venom, you'll love Kraven the Hunter or Silver Sable International or whatever you end up doing. Or my personal choice, Silver Sunny International. Mm-hmm. But to your point, Nick, it's gonna be a tough sell, I think, in some ways. But of course, you know, I thought this movie would be a tough sell. But I would argue that in the case of Kraven, and also if Spider-Man's in the movie, and if Kraven is antagonistic to Spider-Man, are we supposed to be rooting against Spider-Man in the movie?
I don't know. That's why this whole thing is just a weird series of ideas. Venom, there's at least some precedence for something of an anti-hero type take. The same thing with Morbius the Living Vampire to a lesser extent. And with Black Cat. But Silver Sable and Kraven, they're villains. That is what they are. You know, you can't...
Well, Silver Sable's a mercenary.
That's true, I guess. But I mean, you know what I mean. But what was the other one? They rumored for a while they were going to do. Before Marvel decided to use him, wasn't there rumor about a Mysterio movie? Something. I mean, like yeah, stuff like that. Yeah. You know, just doesn't make any sense to me.
I think they need to do a Shocker movie.
Oh, that would be awesome.
But it needs to be about the mid-2000s TNA. Lucha wrestler Shocker.
No, it needs to be about the ultimate version of the Shocker, who is portrayed as like the ultimate like screw up of the supervillain community, and how he just goes around getting his ass kicked the entire time.
I was going to say, Nick, I've said that for a long time. I think if you want to make a really good non Spider-Man involved Spider-Man movie, mm-hmm. they should take a page out of that Nick Spencer series.
Yeah, Superior Foes of Spider-Man.
Superior Foes of Spider-Man. That would be a good movie mm-hmm. and a good different movie. That, again, you probably won't see from Marvel. So, anyway, on the Marvel Cinematic Universe side, let's transition over to the MCU, which currently is utilizing Spider-Man. We got the completely unsurprising but no less exciting announcement that director and writer Ryan Coogler is back on board for Black Panther 2. Mm-hmm. Not much to say about this. What?
Black Panther what now?
Black Panther 2.
There you go.
And exciting news here, Nick. Not much to say about this one, really, but great move by Marvel to get him locked up for another film.
Yeah, not unexpected, but you know, Marvel does have something of a spotty track record when it comes to actually bringing people back for sequels. So, you know, lately they've gotten better about it. They've developed more long-term relationships with their filmmakers, and I'm glad that Coogler was another example of that. Hot commodity, need to keep him in the fold as long as you can.
Well, keeping him in the fold is certainly easier than maintaining your place in the folds of time. Time is a big part of the Flash universe. And in a pretty surprising turn of events here, Nick.
Shocking. Stunning. Who could have seen this coming?
Caught both of us off guard here.
Right.
Report came out this week from Variety that the Flash solo film.
Oh, man.
Which, of course, had been called Flashpoint, it may not end up being that, has now been delayed officially until 2021.
Oh.
It was originally expected to begin filming in March of 2019 for a 2020 theatrical release.
Despite the fact that they don't have a script still.
They don't have a script. They don't have a story.
They don't have a cast.
Now it says filming on Flash will likely not commence until late 2019. Nick, this came out of left field.
I don't
know what to make of this project.
Oh man, you know what would be great is if they could just keep delaying this and keep delaying it, and then it never winds up getting made. This version of the Flash, I have no interest in seeing in a film. You can take your Ezra Miller Flash. You can shine him up real nice.
Real nice.
You can turn that sumbitch sideways and stick him straight up your behind.
I like the fact that you censored yourself, Nick.
It was a reference to a Mark Briscoe promo. Sorry.
I was thinking maybe we're taking Star Wars becoming a more family-friendly product.
Never.
Now, I have to disagree with you here, Nick, because if we don't get this Flash movie, we may never get to see the Flash adapted to a live-action medium.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he's never been done in any other live-action medium, and he certainly hasn't been done better than Ezra Miller could ever hope to in any live-action medium. So better go ahead and get this while we can.
In any event, we'll see what becomes of the Flash movie. Well, one project that was legitimately surprising, all sarcasm removed, all snarkiness removed, a legitimately surprising announcement from the world of entertainment this week, at least for me. Maybe Nick wasn't a surprise. I don't know.
This was very surprising to me.
But
it's a great idea, for the record.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of my favorite under-the-radar DC concepts of the last 15 years from around the time of Infinite Crisis is Secret Six. Mm-hmm. Which was a largely Gail Simone-driven project. It had an ongoing title. There were several mini-series related to it. There was a brief revival a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Secret Six is kind of like, well, I would describe it as a more interesting version of the Suicide Squad.
Right.
And it is a version of the Suicide Squad that, to me, has perhaps more ongoing legs because they are not tied to the concept of having the explosives. They're supervillains who have somewhat of a moral code and a shared purpose in this case. And yet they're still unrepentantly villainous. Anyway, the news announcement from Variety again is that CBS is actively working on production of a Secret Six live action TV show. According to the magazine, it's about, quote, six morally ambiguous strangers, each with their own unique specialties and secret pasts, brought together by an enigmatic figure who blackmails them into working as a team to expose the corruption of the corporate and political elite. So it is a very similar concept to the Suicide Squad, but the way that Gail Simone wrote these characters and the humor with which she imbued this series really defined it for me. No timeline on this, obviously, but it looks like it's going to be at CBS. And I am stoked for this, Nick. I know you haven't read as much of Secret Six as I have, but I know you've liked what you've read.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm still pretty excited about it based on the what I have read. My only concern about it is that it's going to be at CBS. And we know the last time they had something at CBS, it only lasted a season before being moved over to the CW. Wouldn't surprise me at all if that wound up being the same fate here, you know. And it might not be a bad idea if this doesn't just go straight to CW and start off there. I know they have talked about not wanting to have more comic book programming at the moment, but I say screw that. It's without question your highest rated, most well-regarded content on your network. Lean into that. Take advantage of it. But then again, we have to remember the one area that being on CBS really helped Supergirl, that special effects budget was
awesome.
Much better than what they have on CW now. And for Secret Six, especially, I'm thinking of one of my personal favorite characters that they used, Ragman. I'm hoping they can...
Ragdoll.
Yeah, Ragdoll. They can use that special effects budget to do some pretty cool stuff.
Oh, man. Yeah, he is, for those who haven't read the series, Ragdoll is my favorite of the team as well. He's awesome. He's so funny and just so depraved and off the wall. It's great, a great character. Mm-hmm. So really excited about that. Well, you mentioned that Supergirl got moved from CBS to the CW, so let's move over to the CW, Arrowverse.
Mm-hmm.
And we got a pretty pretty awesome, actually, poster released for the upcoming crossover event later this year titled Elseworlds. Of course, we mentioned on a recent episode that Elseworlds has value to longtime DC fans because that was the imprint under which DC would print its sort of what-if stories, its alternate universe stories about its characters. Well, this poster kind of sets the tone for what we might be seeing here as we get Oliver Queen in the Flash costume and Barry Allen in the Green Arrow costume. The traditional hood. Really cool poster here. Check it out online. Stephen Amell tweeted it out. You can find it at any number of sources online. But a really cool poster to set the stage for what should be another fun and wacky crossover.
Yeah, absolutely. This just gives you another look at how this crossover is going, leaning into the full absurdity at times of the alternate universe storytelling that DC is capable of. So this should be a lot of fun. Looking forward to it immensely.
And finally this week, folks, with all the good news around us in the world of comics, there has
comes
to come some
even better news.
Tragedy as well. And I come to you this week, folks, with gloom and doom news.
I have it. No, it's ding dong, the witch is dead.
Netflix.
Yes.
For the first time has canceled a Marvel series.
Yes.
Netflix.
And it's the one that deserved to die, damn it.
Has canceled Iron Fist.
Yes, and in its place will now be airing Karen Page.
Oh God. Ugh. Ugh. I would have I haven't even watched Iron Fist. I'm sure it's not Iron Fist Season 1. I'm sure Season 1 of Iron Fist is really bad. But I would literally sit down and watch all of Iron Fist if it meant Karen Page getting wiped out of the Netflix universe.
Well, you know, they seem to be adapting a certain storyline
in
Season 3. So
they're not going to do it, though, Nick. They're not going to do it.
It would not surprise me, I'll put it that way. Would surprise me in the least.
I think we're going to get Foggy Nelson killed, and I think
that would be
get,
terrible.
I think we're going to get an entire season of Karen crying,
mm-hmm.
And then she's going to go on to Punisher season 2 if that happens, and cry some more.
And she was great in Punisher season 1, so there you go.
I haven't seen it yet. I'll have to get to it whenever I get done with this bullshit show you want me to watch before I get to Punisher.
Are you actually going to watch it, ever?
No, I don't want to watch Iron Fist. I have heard Season 2 from some people. I've heard mixed reactions to Season 2.
Yeah,
some people have told me that Season 2 is much better than Season 1 of Iron Fist.
What have other people told you?
Other people have said it's just as bad.
Oh, wow. Goodness, I can't fathom that. There's no way. It can't be that bad.
I agree. It has to be somewhat better. Well, and I haven't even seen Season 1.
Yeah, you gotta see some of it to really make your assessment.
Then I gotta sit through boring, stretched out Defenders as well.
Defenders was fine. It was just fine. That's my ringing endorsement of it.
Well, that's the end of the rundown.
But Punisher is awesome.
I want – that's the one I want to see more than any of the other Netflix shows right now. Well, that and Jessica Jones 2.
Oh, and Jessica Jones season 2 was awesome as well, of course.
But yes, that's all we got for the rundown this week, unless you have any surprise. Oh, we did promise earlier that we'd talk about that AMA. There was an AMA. Ask me.
Yeah, I didn't even see this, so you'll have to tell me about this.
From the one of the executives at Skybound and from the lead story developer on Walking Dead, the final season. Among the items discussed is that there's currently no timetable for when they're going to be getting these out, these remaining episodes out, or when they're going to put it back on sale, the first two episodes. Just that it is going to happen. They don't know yet. When they find out, they'll make it public. But that they are committed to finishing the game. It's a new process for Skybound. They've never made a video game before. So they have helped with the creative process for all these games. They've just never had to actually take the publishing in-house. So working on that, they say that they are going to continue working for integration, for choices and things like that. There are a lot of complexities to it, but that it's coming. It's going to happen. From a story standpoint, they're really keeping tight-lipped about things. But the question was asked, will we ever see Clementine in the comics? And they said, highly unlikely, but never say never. They also said that they opened the door to possible future content, because it was said, the developer said, what kind of content would you guys like? And there were a couple of cool suggestions in there. Somebody said a DLC about Kenny between seasons 1 and 2. What happened in that missing time? Which I think is an interesting story to tell. So there could be more Telltale content. We got to keep our fingers crossed on that.
Yep. Awesome. Good to hear.
And that's it. And now, Nick, the rest of the story, which for the hard-traveling fanboys means it's time for a segment that occurs every week right here on the show, where we bring out a man in a bear costume who will pretend to masturbate.
And this week, he will pretend to masturbate in front of the Venom symbiote.
Tim, that was for you, buddy. Venom Forkers of Twitter, unite.
Venom Forkers.
What is this segment? Oh, yeah, it's the one where we talk about what we've been reading, watching, and other stuff. And it's a segment we like to call... Reading, watching. Nick, what you been reading?
Nothing.
I have been reading 1994's Zero Hour.
Ah, yes.
Crisis in Time. In preparation for my appearance on the DC Post-Crisis Management podcast here in, a very short period of time, the next week or so. I believe I've gone cross-eyed.
Can't wait to hear more about that.
Indeed. Well, other than that, I haven't been reading anything. But guess what, Nick?
What's that?
Our stories are back.
Our stories are back, yes.
And the first of our stories to come back occurred last week with the season 5... 4? 5.
5? 5?
Yes. Because it was Reverse Flash, Zoom, Savitar...
The Thinker. Yeah.
So, 5.
5.
Premiere of The Flash.
Yes. The point is The Flash is back, damn it.
The Flash is back, for God's sake.
The numbers are irrelevant, for God's sake.
And unlike most season premieres in the Arrowverse, there is no passage of time from the ending of season
literally seconds
four
later.
At the beginning of season five. It takes place seconds later as Barry Allen, this is no spoiler here, Barry Allen and Iris West have encountered their daughter from the future, Nora. And Nora's got a bit of a problem. She is stranded in the past, or so she says. And also has directly interfered in the present course of events, which could set off a chain of events. We don't know. It is addressed in the episode, and other things are addressed as well, Nick, including a return to the perpetually teased disappearance of the Flash in the future in a crisis event. Red Skies included. That famous newspaper headline that goes all the way back to the first season. We catch up on all of our familiar characters. There is no Wells yet on this season. I suspect we will see a Wells later in the season. Hopefully soon. But we get to catch up on everybody else's status quo. We also, everybody knew that Kenan Lonsdale was leaving the show as Wally West, so we get to kind of write him off. And also a very brief glimpse at who will at least initially be the big bad of this season, Sakata. But overall, I thought this was a fun and fast-paced opening to the season. Not very action-packed. I know my mom actually didn't like this episode very much because there wasn't much action in it. But I really dug it because I liked getting back to the basics of the Flash to a degree. Back to the basics of love. And I particularly liked seeing Barry. Now, he did mope a little bit in this episode, but seeing Barry get to have fun at the end and get to smile again, because that's one of the big things that I miss about Flash Season 1 is just how much fun Barry Allen had being the Flash.
Right.
And he hasn't really had much chance to enjoy being the Flash because it's been one tragic event after the other. So I'm hoping that we get a good dose of that this season. Not all the time, obviously. I don't want it to be happy-go-lucky slapstick hour. But
right.
But you know, a little bit more of that this season would be cool. And I thought this was a great start to it. I think it gives Iris an interesting story of where she is trying to figure out why her daughter is avoiding her to such a degree. Nora is a great addition to the cast, I thought, which I would say that this show, more than any of the others on the CW, has a pretty much flawless record in terms of casting people. Their casting has been outstanding from the get-go, and they nailed it again with Nora. Just a really good palate cleanser to set up this new season.
Yeah, the only concern I have is with her coming on as a full-time, or seemingly anyway, a full-time cast member for the time being. You know, we've already seen Wally has kind of already left the departed, which is frustrating considering he's not really going to be on Legends a ton this season. I just worry that they are going to struggle with the ensemble the way they have at times and shortchange, you know, Ralph Dibny in particular is a concern of mine. Not much to do for Ralph here in this opening episode, but those are minor concerns for the most part. I really enjoyed the episode. I think Nora brings something interesting to it, and I'm like you, I'm intrigued to see where they go with the crisis mystery being reintroduced.
Now, here's the question I have for you. Do you think the crisis being reintroduced is going to play a factor this season, as in potentially this season's crossover or later in the season, or do you think this is, like I do, that this is a build to something even greater down the line?
I'm thinking next season's crossover.
That's what I'm thinking too.
Yep.
I think next season is going to be your major crossover. That, again, I'm going way out on a limb here probably. I think next year's crossover is where they're going to combine all the universes into one.
I agree.
I think you're going to get Supergirl and her world combined into the Earth, quote, Earth One. I think Black Lightning, well, maybe not, but I think Black Lightning will be integrated as well onto that universe, into that universe, rather. as a result of the crisis. And I think it's going to be awesome. But we got a long way to go to get there. We have to make sure none of the shows get canceled in the meantime. So, good stuff on The Flash. And that brings us to Black Lightning, which also saw its season 2 premiere this past week. Picking up...
And it's interesting. I don't remember. Has it been confirmed if this is going to go the full season, or is it a short season again?
I don't know. I haven't read.
Because last time, remember, they held it for a mid-season debut, and then it ran through the end of the typical CW season. And this time out, it's starting, you know, alongside our other big shows. So I'm wondering if this is a full order or not.
It's a good question, especially with Batwoman joining the slate of shows.
Yeah, but that probably won't, you know, be until next year, until 2019 at the earliest.
Oh yeah, good point. Yeah,
because they're doing the backdoor pilot. And
tell me more about this backdoor pilot.
Yeah, they're gonna do the backdoor pilot in the crossover. So probably be some time.
The answer to your question is I don't know. Mm-hmm. I just don't know. And so we'll have to see how it goes. But regardless, we get the start of this new season, and already it starts out different from last season with this what appears to be a comic book style approach to story arcs. Mm-hmm. The opening story arc is going to be called The Book of Consequences. And this first episode was Chapter 1, Rise of the Greenlight Babies. And there's this awesome framing sequence, Nick, at the beginning of the episode that sets it up like a comic book. And it's got a great soundtrack, which the show has always had. Hmm. But in addition to that, setting up this almost Quentin Tarantino-style 70s homage opening sequence, which I thought is one of the best things this show has ever done. One of my favorite intro sequences, maybe in the history of the CW, in terms of something that just got me pumped to the point where I was somewhat skeptical of how they'd follow up season one, and I was 100% sold on this season just after that opening, maybe 3-4 minute sequence, concluding with a killer fight scene that included a shocking death, Nick, right out of the gates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I obviously wasn't as high on the opening as you were. It was still a very good opening, but the rest of the episode, you know, went on to deliver. Minor quibbles here and there with the dialogue. I think you and I offline talked about the church scene in particular, where we've got to sue the government. It's going to cost us exactly $500,000 to sue the government, and they arrived at this number arbitrarily somehow.
Yes.
And then also a little bit of a character frustration with the character of Lynn, who it felt like they were going out of their way to make her a little unlikable. But even by the end of the episode, it felt like they started to walk that back a little bit.
Course corrected a little bit, yeah. Lynn had that problem at times in season one.
She did.
And that's something that, frankly,
but it felt
all
like
the CW
part
shows
of the story of of season one was getting over that, was her coming back, her and Jefferson reuniting and coming back together. And now I don't want to see that as a continued ongoing dynamic in every episode, just because, like, you know, we've moved past it. It's growth. You know, we can.
Right. As a writer, you have to understand that your audience only has so much patience for characters who consistently complain about your lead character.
Right.
And of course, there's a fine line between that and Rick Grimes.
Right. We're not saying we want a Rick Grimes situation, but, you know,
he is. But we don't want to hear that everything in the world is Jefferson's fault, when we know, as an audience, we're constantly shown that he is trying to do the right thing for everybody around him. Mm-hmm. And most people close to him know that, even if they don't agree with his actions. So it was a great episode, though. I loved it. I was just pretty much blown away by every part of this. The ending sequence was awesome with Tobias Whale.
Whale, yes.
And his harpoon of doom, that was really great, and excited to see where all this goes. I don't know what Jennifer's powers are exactly, but she appears to certainly to have a more diverse power base than her father or her sister.
Yes.
So that's
going
to be interesting to see.
That is going to be an interesting aspect to watch. Watch as it develops. Let's just wait and see how it all plays out.
Wait and see how it plays out. Who's gonna last?
It's a 14-week race to the top.
Oh, anyway. Claymation 5 pound.
Now the slow clap for the Hampton Inn commercial. That's my favorite.
Oh, that is a good one too. That Hampton Inn commercial. I'm surprised they didn't bring back Claymation Finebound this year.
Well, you know, that was something so special. It can only happen once. It was a moment in time that can never be recreated.
A moment in time.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, because we have decided, we should explain our methodology for what shows we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
We have decided to end our week on Monday, right?
No.
Sunday.
Yes.
So Monday to Sunday is right. The week that we're looking at in CW shows.
Mm-hmm.
So that means we will not be talking about Arrow, because there will be weeks where we may not have time to watch Arrow before right. recording the show.
Right.
So we will be talking about that on the next week's episode of Hard Traveling Fanboys. We will be talking about the freaking amazing premiere of Arrow. I can't wait to talk about it with
you. Now, see, this is going to be the awesome – the great thing is Greg last year, we would do this with episodes of Supergirl, because last year Supergirl was a Monday show. And he would watch both of them and then forget which one he was supposed to be talking about. So Greg will be thoroughly confused about Arrow the entirety of this season.
Yes, that's it's going to be a perpetual thing, I can already tell you, because I can't wait. Arrow's the one that I can't wait on.
You say that, but now that it's on Mondays, as we discussed earlier,
yes,
you know,
I have to wait on it.
You'll have to wait on it. You know, not to tell tales out of school, not to get too deep into all the sausages made. But we're recording this episode on Wednesday. Typically, we record on a Tuesday. So, under our standard Tuesday record date, you know, we probably neither of us will have had time to watch Arrow, right. which will help somewhat.
Correct. Nonetheless, we got to wrap up with Supergirl. Because Supergirl made her premiere this past Sunday night. Supergirl's on a brand new night, Sunday night, and which, again, I question the wisdom of, personally. I don't think Sunday's a good night for a show to be on. When you've got Sunday night football, you've got other sporting events like the World Series.
The Walking Dead, which is, you know,
Walking Dead.
Trending down, but still, you know.
Still very popular.
Still very popular, yes.
And HBO often has a Sunday night show, whether it be Game of Thrones or Ballers or whatever, that will come on. In any event, I question the wisdom, but I'm not Jonathan CW, the president of the CW.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Supergirl premiered and kind of set the stage for this season, which is going to be focusing on a growing anti-alien sentiment in America, as aliens have now, after the events of the first season and on, so on, aliens are now at the forefront of American culture. They are legal citizens, but the sense of nationalism and, I guess, earthism is so strong in the country that humans are now rebelling against the aliens and want them excised. A little bit of an X-Men situation, actually, except instead of mutants, it's aliens that are being feared and oppressed for being different. And there's a lot of obvious social analogies here to current events. The different philosophies taken by Supergirl, by Jon Jones, who is no longer acting as the Martian Manhunter, but is kind of living as a man among the people, and also the DEO, and how they're dealing with these threats. And of course, Linda Carter as the president, who we know is an alien, but the public doesn't know that yet as of the beginning of this episode. So a lot of stuff goes on here, a pretty fast-paced episode. We also see Lena Luthor both continue to be a person who is loyal to the people that she loves, and also continuing to slip down that slippery slope of, say that 45 times fast, of not immorality perhaps, but yeah, the slope of immorality where she's bending the rules a little bit, she's lying just a little bit, But you can start to see where she's starting to descend in a way similar to, for people that watch Smallville, may have seen Lex on that show start to descend slowly. Once you cross that threshold, you see them start to slide a little bit towards that Luther family corruption. But really, really good stuff across the board here. I enjoyed this opener a lot more than I was expecting to, Nick. For whatever reason, I wasn't super pumped about this season of Supergirl, but this first episode did a good job of changing that.
Yeah, I enjoyed it very much as well. I thought, you know, clearly with the alien plot that they're going with, they're attempting to, you know, have a bit of real world commentary. And anytime the CW shows attempt to do that, there is a tendency to lay it on a bit heavy, you know, to come on a bit strong with your message. And I thought there were times here where it was a tad bit ham fisted, but altogether, I think it's an interesting subplot to tackle, and I am somewhat intrigued by this Kasnian Supergirl that they teased once more at the close of this episode. So, like you, I thought this was a pretty good start to the season, and I'm interested to see where they go from here.
Yes, when the CW shows try to get political, you get. You go between or get more ham-fistedly political, you can get on the good side, the Arrow gun control episode, or on the bad side, the Supergirl gun control episode from last year.
Yes.
So this was definitely closer to the former, so that's good to see. Big fan of it. Interested to see where it goes. Now, let's rank them, Nick.
All right.
I'll go first. I got it. Yeah, I got it Black Lightning, I've got it Flash, and I've got Supergirl.
I've got Flash, Black Lightning, Supergirl.
Very good. The standings begin. But I'm not done, Nick, because also on Sunday
I'm done, but you're not done. So let me just sit over here and
You're not done either, Nick.
Take me a little siesta.
No, you're actually not done. Remember? You watched something else.
I did. Damn it. Go ahead.
So, I watched episode 2 of season 9, or 8? 9, of AMC's The Walking... Is it 9?
I don't know the answer, and I don't care. Continue.
The new season of AMC's The Walking Dead. Walking Dead month. We reviewed the season premiere last week right here on Hard Traveling Fanboys. Find that in the archives at PlaceToBeNation.com, PTBNPop.Podbean.com, or on iTunes. How'd you like that, Nick?
get your chapstick out, Bruce.
I wasn't there! Season 2 of this season of The Walking Dead... I know last week we were kind of ho-hum on the premiere. Both of us thought it was pretty good, not enough to hook us back in. Certainly for Nick, it wasn't enough to hook him back in to the series.
Well, it doesn't have to hook you back in. You never left.
Well, you didn't either until this past episode.
No, like, but you have to understand, I only watched last week's episode because we had Walking Dead month. I had no intention of actually – I had deleted the show from my DVR. You know, it has no – place on my queue anymore. My decision was mostly made. You know, it would have taken an all-timer episode to get me to come back in.
Yes, it would have taken a new The Grove.
Mm-hmm.
But and while this episode was not The Grove, I wish that this had been the season premiere in many ways, because this episode of The Walking Dead was awesome. I was blown away. I thought it was the best Walking Dead episode in... Maybe because my mind is clouded by how much I hated the finale last year, I felt like it was the best Walking Dead episode in a long time. It was an episode that, to me, gave me all kinds of new hope for where this season can go, because it was a step back to when the show handled things in a much more clever and nuanced manner. There was no black and white, this is right, this is wrong. There were shades of gray. There were characters making great points on different sides. There were characters behaving like human beings and being angry with one another, but yet not hatching a plan to kill one another. This was The Walking Dead at its best. This was a throwback episode to back when the show was at its best in terms of compelling. When The Walking Dead's at its best, there doesn't need to be a lot of action because you're interested in what the characters are saying. And I think for a long time, we haven't been interested in what these characters are saying because they behave oddly, they change their minds off camera, they behave in ways that are only there to serve the plot rather than the character. This is setting up to be a very character-driven season and a season that is not going to make any of the decisions easy for any of these characters. Natural conflict with some societal comparisons, doing a very good job of being making a political point in a subtle and nuanced way. It was a great episode. I really enjoyed it. And in addition to being great from a character standpoint, all that, the action that was there added up to probably the grossest episode of The Walking Dead since the deaths of Glenn and Abraham at the hands of Negan. There was a scene involving Aaron in this episode that was among the grossest things I've ever seen on The Walking Dead. It was just stomach-churning stuff. And great acting as there always is on this show. So for me anyway, this episode went a long way towards actually providing hope for the rest of this season. I thought it was excellent. I think the new showrunner, Angela Kang, should be applauded for what she's doing in terms of cleaning up the mess of the 2-year-long Negan saga. And I hate to say that because I like Negan and I like Jeffrey Dean Morgan a lot, but clearing that a little bit of that mess up and righting the ship in a way. And I know that it's not going to matter to you, Nick, but I just have to say for somebody that has been burned by this show so many times and has been so negative on this show and how it's gone the last couple of years, this was a real breath of fresh air. And I was happy to see that folks like David Sunday, Todd Weber, others that have been just as ho-hum on the show in recent years also enjoyed this one. I hope they can continue this moving forward. If they can, it'll be great. If they fall back to old habits, then, you know, what can I say?
What can you say? Well, I'm glad to hear you enjoyed it. And here's hoping that it continues its upward trend and you continue to have reasons to keep watching the show. But you mentioned earlier that I also watched something this week, and mm-hmm. I did. And I watched something that you've already given your thoughts on here on the mm-hmm. PlayStation Absolutely. Pop Network as you joined Russell Sellers to talk about the first episode of the DC Universe streaming services Titans. Danielle drove back from Louisiana, so I had some time to lay there in the seat, and I pulled it up on my phone. I watched the first episode. Granted, it was on my phone, so probably not the best viewing experience, but I watched it nonetheless. And, you know, we had talked about how neither of us were overly excited about Titans, not because of disinterest in the concept, but because of disinterest in it seemingly virtually every creative decision they had advertised to us based on trailers and marketing material and whatnot. So I came into this with the lowest of expectations, and I have to say, based on those low expectations, those expectations were exceeded. Were they exceeded to a degree where I am now absolutely hooked and can't wait to see what happens next? Not necessarily, but they were exceeded enough that I watched the episode and went, hey, that was decent. It was fine. I was stunned by how invested I was and how much I cared about all the stuff going on with Raven. That was easily, far and away to me, the strong point of the episode. The other stuff was hit or miss. Though the dialogue was a bit clunky at times, but you know that's to be expected. Most of the other episode outside of Raven focused on one, Dick Grayson, and I thought this stuff was mostly fine. Didn't set my world on fire, didn't do a ton for me to really justify the listen, like I'm not saying this as someone I'm not saying this as someone who has a problem with violence or darkness. Anyone who listens to me on a weekly basis knows that I don't have a problem with getting a little grim from time to time. But characters like the Punisher or characters like this the early version of Oliver Queen on Arrow or characters like, you know, the Red Hood, if they were ever to get there on DC Universe, warrant a level of violence and a level of grim that I don't feel like the character of Dick Grayson, at least in any incarnation that I've ever enjoyed, warrants. And so you have this alleyway fight scene that I understand, you know, partially what they were going for to try and set up the idea that he's been corrupted by Batman in some way, but it still just felt a bit gratuitous. It felt like something they were doing just because they could, just because they weren't on a network, and it didn't really feel in keeping, for me anyway, with the character. But to a much larger extent, the stuff they do with Starfire in this episode, where she literally is incinerating people and smirking about it, I'm no Starfire expert. You know, I haven't read a ton of old Teen Titans comics. My exposure to her largely comes through...
Have you conversed?
I have not conversed with Starfire. My exposure to her largely comes with through cartoons and just kind of ancillary knowledge. But my limited understanding of the character does not suggest that she would be overly thrilled about burning people alive. Yeah, that's going to be my concern going forward, is how are these characters handled? You know, it's not necessarily the violence itself. It's, does the violence fit the characters? And for me, in this episode, I would say mostly no. But the Raven stuff was so good that it made up for it. And so I'm at least intrigued to see where they go from here.
Very good. And some of those points I agreed with, some of those points I didn't. But to hear more, listen to the PTBN Pop Blast of our review of the first episode of Titans. I don't want to belabor any of those points. Good points all around, Nick. Glad to hear your view of it. And also glad that it at least slightly exceeded your expectations going in. Mine were so dirt low and was pleasantly surprised. But again, not, you know, it ain't no Arrow or Legends or anything like that, but you know, maybe there's potential to perhaps become something not unlike something that you could confuse with being a show on that level. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, that notwithstanding, nevertheless, I want to hit all my catchphrases. I got nothing else. Oh, but you have been playing something, have you not, Nick?
Yeah, so, you know, we talked a few weeks back about how I was inspired by the Spider-Man PS4 game to go back and play some of my other favorite superhero games of all time. So I've been replaying the Arkham series and got up to Arkham Knight, and I realized that I never actually finished some of the DLC from the game a while back. Specifically, the story-based DLC that actually added additional side missions into the game was one of the last bits of DLC that they released, and so I never got to play it. So I've been playing through Arkham Knight, and I have now played all the story-based side mission DLC, those being Mad Hatter missions, Mr. Freeze missions, Ra's al Ghul missions, and Killer Croc missions. And I must say, all four were excellent. I would say the Mad Hatter was probably the weak link of the four, with Ra's and Croc being about on the same level. But I have to say, that Mr. Freeze DLC for Arkham Knight is among the best things the Arkham series has ever done in terms of storytelling. It does something with the character of Mr. Freeze and his status quo that I have not encountered. I'm sure someone somewhere has done it in a comic or a cartoon somewhere, but I've never seen it done. And to me, if you ever did a Mr. Freeze movie, like a bit, you know, another shot at him on the big screen, I think a combination of Heart of Ice, the classic animated series episode, with this DLC would be the perfect Mr. Freeze story with a beginning, middle, and an end.
Wow, that's high praise, Nick.
I stand by it. It was poignant. It was bittersweet. It was legitimately an emotional playing experience watching what plays out for the character of Mr. Freeze in this DLC.
Very good to hear. Well, now I have to ask you this, Nick. Now that you've finished your playthroughs of all these Batman games.
I've not yet finished my playthrough of Arkham Knight. I finished the DLC for Arkham Knight.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
But I will say, with it, having not yet finished it, you're going to ask me how Spider-Man stacks up against them, I'm assuming?
Yes.
Arkham Knight would be my favorite of the four.
Wow, over City.
Yes, I've had that opinion for a while. Arkham Knight, to me, perfects the combat, adds new dynamics. The Batmobile stuff is controversial. Some people like it, some people hate it. I fall down the side of really liking it. It gives you the biggest playing environment in terms of an open world, and I think the side missions are a pretty drastic improvement in Knight over City, for me personally, anyway. So, yeah. So, Arkham Knight. And then it's like, it's Arkham City and Spider-Man PS4 neck and neck. I mean, if you put a gun to my head right now, I might lean Arkham City, but I've, you know, that's without having played any of the DLC for Spider-Man PS4, so let's revisit that in a while. And then, of course, Arkham Asylum would pull up the rear in that foursome.
Very good, very good. Well, that's good information to have, Nick. And with that information now on deck, I believe that will bring an end to reading, watching, and indeed playing. And I'm looking over to the side here at the grandfather clock that I have, as you know, in my apartment that leads to a secret compartment underneath the apartment where I dress up and fight crime. The grandfather clock indicates, Nick, that I'm stalling for time in order to put 1 minute on the clock. Nick, it's time, if you can believe it, for the wrestling minute. Wow. I mean, where to begin in the world of wrestling? We've got Chris Jericho set to defend his IWGP Intercontinental Championship against Evil.
You've got David Bixenspan giggling and masturbating furiously in his basement somewhere.
Also known as a typical Tuesday. you've got Middle Eastern countries dealing with WWE. You've got Shawn Michaels apparently coming out of retirement. Or is he? We don't know what's going to happen. You've got Becky Lynch being just the hottest performer in the company right now. You've got Evolution is indeed a mystery, as it turns out. You haven't seen the segment yet, so I don't want to spoil it for you, Nick, but it was a great segment with a nice tease of things to come, including Batista talking about the baby's arm holding an apple.
I need to check that out. That all sounds good. Yeah, I only watched Raw. It's a fine episode of Raw. All that other stuff sounds great. You know, we'll see if WWE Crown Jewel winds up being a thing or not.
Absolutely. We will see. But that's been the wrestling minute, folks. If you guys have any hot opinions, hot takes about wrestling, you want to get in on the wrestling minute, well, you get your own wrestling minute, because ours is for us.
Now, and of course, this brings an end to our proceedings here on the Hard Traveling Fanboys this week. And as we have done, we have a new tradition here on the show, Greg.
You might say it's a family tradition.
It's a tradition that I think has really caught on already, and so we're gonna have, as we have the last couple of weeks, we're gonna have good old Jim Ross, friend of the show, Jim Ross, come in and serenade us out with a little musical interlude. So let's dial our minds back to, you know, the mid '90s. When country music was as hot as it had ever been. And let's think about, you know, what it was like when we were all young girls and ready to lose our virginity for the first time.
Well, before we get started on this, I just want to thanks for having me on the show again. I appreciate that. You can find me at the Jim Ross Report at a podcast dealer near you. Of course, you can find all of my my barbecue sauces at Ingles Supermarkets across the region. But most importantly, I want to say that this song that I'm going to sing to you guys tonight, it means a lot to me because I was there once, riding in a car with Leroy McGurk. Now Leroy, he was blind. I mean, let's just face it, he was legally blind. And at one point, he dropped a cigar onto his crotch. And well, this is a little bit of what came to my mind. He was working through college on my grandpa's farm. I was thirsting for knowledge, and he had a car. Well, I was caught somewhere between a woman and a child when one restless summer we found love growing wild on the banks of the river on a well-beaten path in the Mid-South Territory. Now, it's funny how those memories, they last. Well, that cigar on Leroy McGurk's crotch, it was like strawberry wine and 17. This hot July moon saw everything. My first taste of love, mother. Oh, bittersweet. Green on the vine like strawberry wine. You know, I still remember when I was 30 and I felt old. My biggest fear was Cowboy fining me for being late to the arena. September was where I had nowhere to go. A few wrestling cards and letters and one long-distance call. Me and old Leroy, we drifted away like leaves in the fall. But year after year, I come to this place just to remember, that taste of strawberry wine and 17. The hot July moon, I saw everything. My first taste of Leroy McGurk's semen was bittersweet. Green on the vine, I told him to go to the doctor and he said it was strawberry wine. Now, there's not done yet, folks, because the fields over Leroy's crotch have grown over now. It's been years since they've seen the plow. There's nothing that time hasn't touched. Is it really him now? Now I'm going to ask you this. Is it really him? Or is it the loss of my innocence? Now you might think that it's the loss of my innocence. Then again, I might think it's him. And both of us can have those opinions, and they can be legitimate. Folks, it doesn't have to be right or wrong. It's bullshit. You can be a Republican and you do on someone's face, or you can be a Democrat and piss all over someone. It doesn't matter. What I'm getting at, the point here, is that it was like strawberry wine. 17, the hot July moon, saw everything. My first taste of love, oh, bittersweet. Green on the vine, like strawberry wine. Strawberry wine. Strawberry good God wine! We'll be right back.